nation's deadly opioid epidemic had its roots in Florida. Why a new series of investigative reports says our own state legislature is directly responsible. Good morning. Hope you had a great weekend. It's Monday, and we are live from Studio 5 here for First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening with us this morning. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, we've got details on a devastating new series of investigative reports looking at Florida's role in the opioid epidemic. Some eye-popping stuff, and you will want to get on the line now with your thoughts and questions. The number to join us, 549-2937. Then later, a local rabbi out at the beaches is hitting the road on his bicycle all across the state of Florida to promote a healthy lifestyle. We'll track his journey up and down the east coast of the Sunshine State. Plus, our own David Luckin on some new music spinning this week in the Electro Lounge. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, it's a devastating new series of stories about Florida's role in America's deadly, tragic opioid crisis. The Palm Beach Post has dug up little-seen data and conducted interviews with officials from across the country. And what they found is shocking. Our own legislature, through a series of actions and inactions, has apparently directly contributed to this crisis. Few people look worse in this report than Senator Marco Rubio, former state legislator, for waiting a decade to crack down on dirty doctors and pill mills in this state. Now, here's Rubio speaking with Preston Scott from Tallahassee and Panama City News Radio about the opioid epidemic.
You hurt your back at work or whatever, the doctor writes you some prescriptions. You build tolerance, you need more, then they cut you off. In essence, there comes a point where they won't write it for you anymore, but now you're hooked on opioids, and then the only other substance you can get is off the street. So people think they're buying heroin, but what they're buying, and the heroin alone is pretty bad, but you know what they're often buying now is heroin laced with fentanyl. In essence, you have no idea how potent what you're taking is, and there's where you're getting the overdoses and the deaths.
However, Pat Beal of the Palm Beach Post writes that it was Rubio's failure to act quickly and his fellow lawmakers that fed the nation's appetite for these pills, making the nation's heroin crisis that much worse. When Florida finally did crack down a decade after the crisis had started raging in 2011. Now, as this information comes to light, at the same time, Jacksonville's pilot program on addressing opiate overdose deaths in our city is actually showing progress. Some good news to report, too. We're beginning the hour with new information about the opiate epidemic as we welcome Dr. Raymond Palm of Gateway Community Services here in Jacksonville. Dr. Palm, always good to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. As we learn about the new investigative report in the Palm Beach Post, pointing the finger directly at the Florida legislature in worsening America's opiate epidemic, we want your calls and questions. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and your tweets to @MelissaInJax. We also welcome your comments on Facebook. And we'll talk about the pilot program in a moment, Dr. Palm, which you created here in Jacksonville, doing just amazing work here on the First Coast. But first, I encourage everyone to go to the Palm Beach Post website and read this series of reports. There's a lot of information here, but the gist of it is that for a solid decade, key lawmakers in the state legislature, including Marco Rubio, now a senator, along with heads of agencies, repeatedly looked the other way as crooked doctors and bogus clinics around Florida flooded nearly half of America with this highly addictive and deadly opiate drug, this scourge that is taking so many lives across this country. This is not news to you, Dr. Palm, is it?
Correct, Melissa. Even though I wasn't knowledgeable as far as specific legislators at the time, I know when we began looking at the opioid epidemic, as I was consultant to the Florida Board of Medicine Board of Osteopathic Medicine, Florida Board of Pharmacy at the time, in my role with the Impaired Professionals Program, we were experiencing 5 deaths a day when this all started, when we became aware of it. By the time the legislature acted, we were experiencing 10 deaths a day. We were trying to get the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program approved for 10 years. I do know that we totally lost our direction as a state when the governor got rid of the Office of Drug Control. We have no leadership. We have no strategy. I do want to say that our present Northeast Florida group of legislators have been excellent now in supporting some efforts. But despite their efforts, we still are 50th in the state. The state is still not giving us substantially any new money except for special projects. We're still in the same kind of budget limits as we were 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And so as we learn that not only did Florida wait 10 agonizing years to crack down on this state's out of control, homegrown prescription painkiller scourge that created a nation of opiate addicts and dealers. Not only do we learn this, we really kind of already knew this, but what we're learning in this new investigative series of reports at the Palm Beach Post website is that, according to DEA reports and federal court records, by 2010, Florida was the reliable opioid dealer of choice to users and dealers, not only here in the Southeast, but in the Northeast, the Mid-Atlantic, and the Great Lakes regions, basically everywhere east of the Mississippi River. Florida didn't turn off the spigot of oxycodone until 2011. And at that point, drug users in all of these states east of the Mississippi turned to heroin to feed their addiction.
We became known as the OxyContin Express, the pill mill capital of the country. Greater than 90% of the doctors prescribing were here in Florida. We were prescribing somewhere in the region of 1 million OxyContin prescriptions a month just from this state. People from all the surrounding states were coming to us because we didn't have the laws that were needed. And we were one of the last to create this, at least the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, which has had been so helpful in so many other states.
Not only that, the Palm Beach Post reports that now Senator Marco Rubio, former state legislator Marco Rubio, killed a critical prescription drug monitoring program basically over politics. He was upset about another lawmaker not supporting another bill. So he cast a vote, or he rather moved to kill the prescription drug monitoring bill, which would have been the silver bullet, really, against these deadly pill mills. This was back in 2002, early in the opioid crisis. This reporting points the finger directly at Rubio as being, more than perhaps anyone else in the legislature, responsible for this.
Mm-hmm. And I can't speak specifically to Senator Rubio. However, there was a lot of silence from various areas. As I had said, you know, the governor got rid of the Office of Drug Control, which took away any leadership in developing a direction. And I'm embarrassed to say my own field of medicine, where we were very vocal about at least a joint commission who oversees the hospitals in the country. The Joint Commission actually had a lot to do with pushing more and more opiates to be prescribed. I don't know if you remember the smiley faces, mm-hmm. and people should be drug-free. And up until even present now, JCO has been silent. Our Florida Medical Association has been silent. Where's the leadership? Because I would say any one legislature might actually be pushed in a better direction if there was more pressure.
Let's point out the state legislature to this date still has not done much to address the opiate heroin crisis that they now were learning had a direct role in creating.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Our budget really hasn't moved much in 10 years. There's been special projects that have been funded, but the overall money coming in comes through to us from the government, the U.S. government, which still is not a lot of money when you divide it through by 67 counties. It really is minimal compared to the kind of devastation this crisis is causing.
We're speaking now actually to a local hero, Dr. Raymond Palm of Gateway Community Services. He's created a life-saving pilot program in the city of Jacksonville with the support of the Jacksonville City Council to stem the tide of opiate overdoses in this city, which are at record levels. As we talk about that in a moment, right now, first, let's go to a few of your calls about this devastating series of reports by the Palm Beach Post, looking at how Florida's legislature, it appears, played a direct role in the nation's opiate epidemic that has claimed so many human lives. Give us a call, 549-2937. Mark is on the west side. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. Why am I not surprised that we don't hear anything from ever one of these, you know, landmark investigative reports from the good old Florida Times Union? I mean, Jacksonville is a much bigger city and area than Daytona Beach, yet we never hear our paper, or very rarely do we hear our paper, you know, in the forefront of anything like this. But my question,
well, you know what? What I would say to you, Mark, is the parent company, Gatehouse Media, has cut staff repeatedly, and they're down to less than 40 people. A hedge fund now owns the Florida Times Union, essentially. And so I would only say to you that they're doing the best they can with the staff that they have. I would encourage you to subscribe to them. And
oh, I do.
Okay, go ahead.
It's become the weekly reader of newspapers. Anyway, my question was this. Is there any indication that, I mean, so far, I don't hear anything that makes Marco Rubio, you know, complicit necessarily, maybe lazy and late to the game. Is there any indication that he's been receiving money for his campaign over the years from opioid manufacturers or anything like that, or doctors groups?
Right. Thanks for that. And there's nothing in this series of reports that indicates that Rubio took money. However, as the investigative reporter for this series writes, Governor Scott came in for extremely heavy criticism and suggestions of that type of activity, particularly from officials in Kentucky, Dr. Palm. They went berserk when Rick Scott considered stopping the drug monitoring database in 2011. As much as 60% of the illicit oxycodone in Kentucky came from Florida, according to the Palm Beach Post. Kentucky's Lieutenant Governor Daniel Mangiardo wanted to put up billboards at the Florida state line that read, "Welcome to the Oxy Tourism Capital of the World." Federal lawmakers tried to intervene. The U.S. House Appropriations Chairman Hal Rogers of Kentucky wrote Governor Scott twice. He said, "Canceling Florida's prescription drug monitoring program is equal to firing firefighters while your house is ablaze." This series in the Palm Beach Coast also quotes a Kentucky sheriff in Greenup County. He was convinced Governor Scott was somehow getting money from somewhere to look the other way as this crisis grew. And so, you know, just the outrage from Kentucky in particular is extraordinary to learn about, which so many Floridians are just now learning about, unfortunately.
Very, very frustrating historical piece on this. And I don't understand the legislature's thinking. I don't understand our governor's thinking. I think the analogy is perfect. You know, taking away funding for firefighters when the house is on fire, I think is perfect. The reality is we were so far behind every other state when it came to the prescription drug monitoring program. Again, 10 years to get it enacted. And then when we finally get it enacted, why they would want to take it away, I couldn't even make sense out of that.
549-2937. As we talk about a new investigative series in the Palm Beach Post, pointing the finger at the state legislature for worsening America's deadly opiate epidemic, let's go to Rick on the west side. Hi, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to say that along with Dr. Palm, those of us in the treatment and the recovery community could have written this article 15 years ago. And the alarms were going out, and all the activity that people are now talking about is because the alarm went out. This epidemic was not brought on by nefarious characters smuggling drugs up from Colombia. This epidemic was brought on by so-called legitimate doctors and their allegedly legitimate activities, despite the fact that most major cities could have seen lines, literally lines out the door of the pain clinics on many prominent corners. It was there and everyone knew about it. So always you have to follow the money. And I suspect that if anybody's following the money, it's going to lead, pretty straightforward lines. We need to remember, too, that this is not just a state problem. It's federal. The man who shepherded a bill through Congress that reduced the ability of DEA to do anything about pill mills was nominated by President Trump to be the czar overlooking the opioid. You can't get more foxes in the hen house than on this matter. And everybody will be ducking for cover, I think, soon.
And you said you work in the recovery field, too, Rick?
I have. Well, I am recovering, and I have worked in the field.
Okay. And so can you tell us just a little bit more about your journey through that?
Well, I think I'd rather not.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm sorry.
That's no problem. I understand, because it can be so difficult for so many people. You know, Dr. Palm, I've worked with people myself who have become addicted to opiate medication. One gentleman in particular I used to work with at First Coast News, who started taking these meds after having back problems. And the addiction is so, this is a narcotic that is highly addictive, and you can start getting prescribed this for a perfectly legitimate reason, and it can spiral very quickly out of control. And we've seen that happen to such devastating effect for so many people, so many Americans, which is why you took the initiative to create a pilot program for treatment and recovery here in Jacksonville. Can you bring us up to date on where we are with that program?
Certainly, I would love to. The program began as a 6-month pilot, and the success was beyond my wildest dreams. where we were experiencing 2 deaths a day in Duval County from overdoses, a budget increase, or I'm sorry, a budget drain 3 to 4 times that. That was initially with JFRD and crime rate 5 times. I'm sorry, we had overdoses 5 times the rate of crime or deaths by crime. So the pilot was initiated to try and reduce deaths, reduce repeat overdoses, and we actually had no deaths during this pilot, and only 3 repeat overdoses, which was phenomenal. We were so efficient in how we processed this pilot, we only used 1/3 of the budget, which allowed the city to continue the pilot through this budget year, and we're now trying to also, we will have enough money to continue it if the city approves through the end of September 2019.
And they allocated what, about $1 million, right?
It was $1.5 million initially.
Okay. And you want to expand to work with other hospitals like Memorial, UF Health, is that right?
Memorial, Park West are the next 2 hospitals on board. As of October 1, we're hoping to bring in UF Health. And if we get approved through September 2019, we hope to have 7 emergency departments under the umbrella of the pilot. Where at the same time, our legislature did approve money to also bring this pilot into Clay County as a separate venture.
If you're just tuning in, right now we're looking at the Palm Beach Post's new investigative series pointing the finger directly at the Florida legislature, along with Governor Rick Scott and now Senator Marco Rubio, in worsening America's deadly opiate epidemic. We'll go back to a few more of your calls in a moment at 549 2937. And here's a comment. Dr. Palm of Gateway on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, Rhoda writes, meanwhile, members of the black community were labeled crackheads and given incarceration over rehabilitation for addiction to crack cocaine. That has been a subtext of this whole story. The recognition that the opioid epidemic has touched white America equally, as well as it has touched communities of color, and how addicts in white communities have really been treated quite differently by the criminal justice system most of, not all of the time, but a good part of the time. The racialized aspect to this.
Yeah, there's absolutely no question about that. And that's a very sad statement. But that brings us also to a whole nother point, and this is very scary right now, where opiates were more of a white person's drug. Cocaine was more of an African-American person's drug. And yes, there was definitive bias when it came to the treatment of those individuals, where blacks were incarcerated at a much greater rate than whites. Here's the scary part. With the opiates, we are now seeing an expansion of the socioeconomic situation, and that there are no boundaries anymore. It's affecting people from 20 to mid-60s, which now has become a huge problem because addicts in general have been considered a throwaway population. And that's a really, really sad statement, I think, reflective in what's been going on in the history of our legislature. Now, what's happening now, unfortunately, is fentanyl, which has been a major problem behind our present opioid epidemic, a little different than the prescriptions and much more lethal. We're now finding 70% of cocaine in, 70% of cocaine being laced with fentanyl.
Really?
So now what we have is African Americans who are using cocaine and never have used opiates before are now being exposed to fentanyl and its unfortunate lethal consequences.
We're seeing even more deaths.
We're not just seeing them. We're going to see an increasing amount over time.
And how is this playing out in Duval County where, you know, JFRD, firefighters, paramedics, they have been telling us for years now that they go from call to call to call all through the day and night, responding to overdoses from these deadly drugs that they can barely keep up. The former medical examiner for Duval County, who ran the morgue, appeared on this program and said that they literally could not keep up with the bodies coming into the morgue that were overdose deaths. That people just have no idea the scope of this, how the toll that this is taking on this community and so many other communities.
Yeah, it's number one, it is not getting better. We did see a slight decrease for a couple of months, but that decrease, I can tell you, was the black market folks must have realized they were killing off their customers. So what they started doing was diluting the fentanyl with something called acetylfentanyl. It's more potent than heroin, but less potent than fentanyl. So it kept people alive more, but kept them addicted to fentanyl. We're seeing this increasingly so, and it's been a very disheartening situation. And now what's happening is we're starting to see the rise again. It's been fairly so an increasing rise over time. The good news is because of the pilot project, JFRD is having a much better perspective as it relates to their compassion fatigue. And they are now seeing some hope. As the ED doctors involved in the pilot project at St. Vincent's Southside and St. Vincent's Riverside, they're now seeing, wait, we have some answers here. That's the good news. Budget problems are still there, but as we expand this project, we are so hopeful that we will continue to see the successes we've seen so far.
Okay, and that's the good news. But I do know that you have a few other points you want to make in terms of not only being aware of these deadly drugs, but other drugs that you're seeing that are being abused, like Xanax. Is that right?
Well, since I have been in this field, I have been very upset with the blatant disregard that Xanax has had on our population. And I don't understand it. Back in the mid-90s or late 90s, early 2000s, when we were having the deaths, I was talking to experts in the field, i.e. experts who were actually testing the blood of the bodies of dead people, and spoke with them about, well, what's going on here? And they said, well, yes, opiates are the cause. However, greater than 90% of the opioids in the system of the people who are dead had benzodiazepines or tranquilizers in their blood too. And greater than 95% of those were positive for Xanax. Now, we were talking about opioids killing people, but no one was talking about the benzodiazepines. I was screaming out at conferences, why are we ignoring these potentially lethal drugs that in combination with alcohol and or opiates increases the risk of death significantly? And only now is it starting to hit the press.
Only now.
Only now.
And only now are we learning the full extent of the legislature's role in this national tragedy. If you go to palmbeachpost.com, you can read the whole series, which we highly recommend. What are your final thoughts about this? What, the takeaway for people that have been listening here this morning?
I'd like one point to make, and then I'll give a final takeaway. During this 10-year period, Purdue Pharma, who manufactured OxyContin, was slapped with multi-billion dollars of suits. And actually, Purdue Pharma, one of the suits, actually compelled them to pay for the prescription drug monitoring program,
which the state refused to implement.
Exactly. They finally approved the prescription drug monitoring program, but it was too late, and Purdue Pharma no longer had to pay for it. Our taxpaying dollars had to pay for this. Look, it's time to, we need not to be quiet anymore. I really want the doctors, the organizations that represent the doctors, and our population to say, hey, enough is enough. We've all got to get together and do something about this. Silence is not going to help. We do have some tools that will work. But unless we get everyone on board, including our state legislators, we're just going to keep dying.
That is the inescapable fact. And again, I can't stress enough how important your work is to this community, Dr. Palm. Dr. Raymond Palm of Gateway Community Services, he's created a pilot program in Jacksonville for those struggling with addiction and possible overdose from opioids. Go to palmbeachpost.com to learn more about our own lawmakers' role in this, unfortunately. Dr. Palm, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
And much more still ahead this morning. Later, we'll spin some new electro lounge music. Our own music director, David Luckin, will tell us what's happening late night in our after hours music block of shows this week here on 89.9. But up next, he's cycling across all of Florida to promote heart health. A conversation with the beach's Rabbi Nochim Korinsky. After this, back in a moment.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app, Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel.
Bobby, the style editor for the Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, last year, Rabbi Nochim Korinsky of Ponte Vedra Beach was at a bar mitzvah celebration when he suddenly felt sharp chest pains. Korinsky, a father of six and the co-director with his wife of Kabbat at the Beaches, soon learned that he was having a heart attack and needed emergency surgery. After that ordeal, the rabbi was told in no uncertain terms by his doctor to improve his health and to start exercising. So he decided to take up cycling. Now, just about exactly 1 year after that terrifying heart attack, the rabbi is taking his show on the road and embarking on a 600-mile journey all the way from Ponte Vedra down Florida's East Coast all the way to Key West. He's cycling the state to promote both physical and spiritual health. Now, we're told the rabbi is just about wrapped up with his incredible journey of Florida by bicycle, and he's on the line with an update. Rabbi Korinsky, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having me. I absolutely love your show.
Oh, thank you.
I'm very flattered that I'm on it.
Well, it's good to have you on it. What a story you have to tell. Now, let's go back to a year ago when you were at this bar mitzvah and you felt chest pains. That's where this began, right? Can you take us back to that day?
Sure. So it was right before our synagogue's annual dinner, our gala event, and I was giving a course and kind of a busy day and a busy time of the year. And so being 36 years old, you know, I felt some chest pains during the day, but I didn't acknowledge them. I didn't realize that there was anything to be, you know, be taken seriously. Because who cares? Who pays attention to their body at 36? So, throughout the day, I kept doing what I was doing. And I went to this bar mitzvah. I went back to go teach the class, and I went back to the bar mitzvah again. And as I sat down at the table and I started sweating. But there was a lot of dancing going on, but I wasn't even dancing. I just came there. I was sweating top to bottom. I started feeling very overheated and kind of closed in. So I took a step outside, and there were a few doctors there. And one of the doctors is a good friend of ours. She's a pediatrician. She came out and she says, "Look, I don't really work on big people. I work on little people, but I think it's worth going to the hospital to check it out." So my wife and I got in the car, and my wife says, "I think this is serious because you want me to drive." So she drove me to the hospital, which thank God wasn't very far. St. Vincent's Hospital, it was only a few blocks from where the bar mitzvah was, and they started doing all kinds of tests, and I think the hospital themselves were kind of surprised. They were, you know, I think that age group, the 30s, is a very uncommon age for. I think the people who have heart defects typically have, from what I learned now, in the 20s, you know, the heart events are typically in your 20s or they start in your 40s. The 30s is kind of that middle age, with that in-between ground where people haven't experienced anything until then, don't usually experience their first heart attack. That's what I found, you know, that's what I found out since. So they, you know, they kept doing all kinds of tests, and finally, you know, they called the cardiologist in and they went in, they took me in for surgery.
And so you had the surgery, you made it through this terrible scare, and then you decided to take your doctor's advice and get fit. You started cycling, right? That was your choice, getting on a bike.
Yeah. So my brother lives in Houston, Texas, and he had a warehouse, and he upgraded a different warehouse, and then, you know, he had this kind of medium-sized warehouse, so which for about a month. But the divine providence in it, or the incredible opportunity in it, was that he had in this little in-between time that he had this warehouse, there was a guy, a bike shop, a bike mechanic, right across the little parking lot from his warehouse, and and they, you know, they became friends. And this turns out this guy was not just a mechanic. He had been a mechanic for the U.S. Postal team, you know, for some of the big teams. He was a master mechanic, but a really high, really unique position, a very specialized position, and a very, very highly qualified guy. And my brother started training with him, and you know, he got into it. And that fellow had a tremendous success rate with cardiac patients. And, you know, so they got to talking, and he says, look, you know, I've seen tremendous things getting people with cardiac issues on a bike. I've seen them, see people improve, you know, just at a really rapid rate, much, much greater rate than other exercises. You know, it's endurance, low impact endurance sport. It's really great for cardiac health. So, you know, they got to talking, and we made arrangements to go after the holidays and after the Jewish holidays. So that was in September of last year. I flew to Texas. My brother set me up on a road bike. And I had no idea what I was getting into, but it sounded like a good idea, and it sounded like fun, and it sounded like a way to get control of my health. And it sounded a lot better than, because I'd been going to cardiac rehab, which, you know, the people at St. Vincent's are wonderful, but there's an experience going to cardiac rehab, and you're going into the hospital, you're going there, you know, you're going in as a patient, you continue to be a patient, and the exercise is kind of minor, and it's not intense, and it's not designed for, you know, a high level of exercise.
Okay, so from the starting to bike, you got this idea to bike all the way from Ponte Vedra Beach to Key West. Where did you get that idea? What sparked this?
So we were biking the first day we biked, and I really loved it. I was really terrible at it, and my brother and I were talking about it. We decided that we wanted to do something that would really terrify us, something that was really just outrageous. So he had biked across Iowa. You know, there's a famous bike ride called the Rag Ride. It's a huge ride. 30,000 people do every year. So we said, why don't we do the same thing in Florida? We live in Ponte Vedra, in northeast, kind of the northeast corner, as you know, and we'll bike down to Key West, so, you know, one tip of the state to the other. And it sounded like an outrageous idea, an outrageous goal. So it seemed like, you know, in the process of getting fit, it seemed like, you know, something to look forward to and to train for. Now, having an event to train for helps you train. And so we came up with this idea. We thought that, you know, it sounds scary. It sounds terrifying. So let's do it.
How was it? You started on June 24th in Ponte Vedra, then made your way down to Ormond Beach, Cocoa Beach, Fort Pierce, all the way down to Homestead, and then all the way down to Key West, which is where I think you were yesterday, correct?
Yeah, and we're here now. We arrived yesterday and we're leaving today.
Okay, so you're going to head back up to North Florida today from Key West. What was the journey like for you all the way down there to 90 miles from Cuba?
It was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. I mean, the group, the key was the group that came with us. You know, some local guys, some people from our synagogue, some just local community members, some family members that came and flew in together, and then we started laughing in Ponte Vedra, and we didn't stop all the way to Key West. We had a great time. We just had a lot of fun, and there was a lot of exercise. We pushed ourselves way past, you know, what we thought we could do, and we increased just all the while. And everyone that came, just our fitness level increased the whole way. We had a really good time. We had all kinds of people. I mean, dozens and dozens of people that kind of joined us for part of it, came, you know, jumped on the ride, off the ride, or came for a day, or came for a couple of days, or as people followed us. They found out where we were on social media. They got an idea, and then they cheered us on as we passed, or, you know, countless people invited us, you know, to their homes. We couldn't take them up on most of their offers, but just the generosity of it, and hundreds and hundreds of emails and texts, people that were inspired, and they said that they wanted to get their health in order. I mean, it was just just incredible. It was just an incredible. It is an incredible experience. It's one of those life changing experiences. And I think for everybody that came.
And you're doing this, it's my understanding, to promote physical health, but also as a rabbi, spiritual health through exercise.
So one of the things that happened was when I, you know, because of my heart attack, I had to take my physical health seriously. And I felt that there was, I just felt internally that the first, you know, I had to learn to, you know, self-care is so important. It's one of those things that I just had not been in tune with before. And then on top of that, there was, you know, and I had to hear I was forced to take care of myself, which is an interesting, it's an interesting lesson itself. And then I felt that part of my time I was in a conflict between cycling and now I've been doing some running and swimming, you know, training for a triathlon. So it takes a lot of time. So I'm taking time. Thank God I have a beautiful family and I have a community and I have, you know, just a balance of things in the world that we have to, we all have responsibilities. And so it seems like they're in conflict. But as I started to make these changes, I started to look back at some of the lessons I had learned, you know, in from my studies and you know, life experiences, that the truth is they're not a conflict. They're not in conflict. Our bodies and our souls are not in conflict. Our spiritual lives and our material lives are not two different things. We're one. Each one of us is one entity. And we believe that we're put on, we as in Judaism believes, we are put, every person is put on this world to make this world a better place one way or another. Every one of us has that opportunity to significantly change their own lives and the lives of the people around them and really make this world a more godly, more just a better place. But to do that, and that comes from our soul. That comes from our desire to, you know, to do good, to bring God in the world, to be, you know, to make a difference. But that can't be done if our body is the vessel for our soul. If our body is weak, then our soul can't do its job. You know, so we can't make this world a better place if we're in the hospital bed or we're not giving ourselves a fighting chance to live or we're not healthy, then not only are we not making the world a better place, we're actually a burden. And so that thought of just being in the hospital and being a burden and saying, you know, I didn't really give myself a chance to live this life, you know, to really do my purpose because I didn't take care of myself. That thought drives me, you know, to be healthy. And so every one of us, 100% of all people die. You know, none of us make it out of this world alive. But I know that it's my belief that the day that we're supposed to die is ordained. It's the day we're going to go. But we want to make sure, at least in my mind, I want to make sure that day comes. I know I did my part to be alive as long as possible to make an impact on the world. And then if it's my time, that's the time that God wants me to go. I'm okay with that. That's fine. But I know that as long as I was here, I did the best I could. And I was healthy and I was alert and I was present. And so the physical health and spiritual health are very, very tied in. You can't have one without the other, in my opinion. That's really what the ride is about. So it's not about, we made corny medals, but it's not really about medals or achievements or how many miles or, you know, whether, God willing, I'll complete an Ironman, you know, you get an Ironman medal. It's not about completing the Ironman. I mean, it's not even about, one of my kids asked me if I do the Ironman, if I fail, if I don't succeed, what am I going to feel like? And I said, I'll probably be upset for about 5 minutes. And then I'll say, you know what? I had a heart attack last year and now I trained for an Ironman. That's great.
Yeah. And it's great that it's great that you are now headed back up here to our part of Florida on your bicycle all the way from Key West today. And so we'll have to see how things go once you get all the way back up to this corner of the state. And I applaud you, Rabbi. It's just an incredible thing you're doing. And we thank you so much for sharing your story with our listeners. And have fun cycling back up here. And be careful, too.
Thank you so very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
He's Rabbi Nochim Korinsky of Ponte Vedra Beach and Chabad at the Beaches, cycling all the way across Florida after 1 year after his heart attack. In a moment, our own music director, David Luckin, spinning on the Electro Lounge tonight. We'll get a preview after this.
England controlled Florida from 1763 to 1783, and the colony remained loyal to King George III throughout the entire American Revolution. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss the shipwreck of a Loyalist fleet. We'll talk about Spanish conquistador Hernando de Soto and Florida bluegrass music. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
You remember Rolling Stone magazine and what it used to be? It wants to be that again.
I didn't come in thinking, I'm going to run this company. I came in thinking, I believe so much in what this thing stands for.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Gus Winter on taking what used to be the family magazine into the digital age. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
What happens when race and disability collide?
Black and brown kids are much more likely to have their behavior seen as bad behavior instead of an actual diagnosis of autism.
After Effect examines the life of a Puerto Rican autistic man with the odds stacked against him. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Mass shootings are becoming more common, but do we know why these tragedies occur? A new report from the FBI finds most shooters obtained their guns legally and did not have diagnosed mental health issues. With active shootings at an all-time high, can we better protect ourselves if we know what to watch for? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, if you're tired of the summer heat, you know what? You just got to stay hot with our Hot Nights Cool Jazz programming on 89.9. It'll transport you to a place where cool breezes blow and jazz fills the air. Our own music director, David Luckin, is breezing into the studio with a little music for us. Hey, David.
Did you notice how warm it's getting? Summer's here.
I've noticed.
So we're going to try and chill you out all summer long from the July 4th holiday at midnight right on through till September 22nd. We're going to...
All summer long.
We'll leave our Relax Radio, which we usually play overnight on our HD channel. So if you like that, it's still there. You can still listen. It also streams. But for the summer, we are playing... We're playing around with Hot Nights, and we're playing cool jazz to equalize it all, make it all work. Maybe so, you can turn your AC down a little and listen to the cool jazz.
Starting at midnight on 89.9, all new July. Block of starting on the 4th of July, all new music.
Over 2,500 songs in rotation, and we've got some new jazz, but most of it's good straight-ahead jazz, as the jazz fans like to say, with Miles and Chet Baker, but we've mixed in Nora Jones and the Nighthawks and DeFaz and some great classic jazz like Miles Davis's Porgy and Bess. Here's a little Bess You Is My Woman from Miles Davis.
That is just the perfect music to listen to late night. I love it.
Exactly. So we got a lot of Miles, a lot of Chet, a lot of Count Basie, Duke Ellington, John Coltrane. And as I said, some new jazz too. We're going to mix in some fresh music. But it's just a nice way to change it up for the summer.
Yeah. And this is a blend of vocal and instrumental tracks. And for younger listeners especially, you're opening them up to decades and decades of the great American songbook, which is so neat.
Absolutely.
And so fun to listen to.
And to help facilitate that, we made sure we got some Sinatra in there and some Michael Bublé and some Nora Jones.
A mix of old and new, yeah.
Diana Krall.
Yeah.
Excuse me. All the great stuff we're going to play.
Now, again, this is Hot Nights Cool Jazz on 89.9 all summer long. We're going to kick this off midnight, July 4th, right when the fireworks start to die out. Our jazz is going to heat up.
We'll pick up. Exactly.
And this is going to last right through Labor Day.
Yep.
From midnight to 5 a.m. every night on 89.9, courtesy of our own music maestro, music director David Luckin. He's always thinking up something new. Now, that's every night starting on the 4th, but also Turntable Tuesday is coming up on your show, The Electro Lounge, tomorrow night. What are you going to be listening
to
then?
We're going to spin one classic album from September 1970. It was released. Neil Young's After the Gold Rush, with so many great songs that everyone knows, from Up on Cripple Creek to Southern Man. Just great songs.
You know, you've been doing Turntable Tuesday for a number of years now. How long have you been doing it?
I think we just started.
Only
maybe
a year?
It's a year. Yeah,
it's hard for me to keep track with all of your ideas, because you're the idea man in this building. You're always coming up with a new cool idea for music, for news, for whatever. Just an endless supply of cool ideas.
And we spin this brand new vinyl or the originals. When we did Brubeck's Take Five, it was the original 59 album.
You'll play the whole album. That's the idea.
The first track to the last. This one, my copy from 1970, is too scratched up to use. So I bought a new copy. So you're going to hear beautiful, fresh vinyl tomorrow night with Neil Young. And we'll mix in. We've got 2 hours to fill, so I'm not sure what I'm going to play besides Neil Young. Because, you know, Melissa, in those days, the whole album's only 35 minutes. So it leaves me a lot of time to fill. Not like CDs that are 80 minutes long.
Isn't it amazing how vinyl has kind of made a comeback?
Sure has.
It's really been something to watch.
I know a lot of young people are buying it.
Yeah, people are collecting them and realizing what gems they are. Even though it was an old-fashioned technology, there was something about the sound of vinyl
It's warm.
There was a warmth and a mellowness to it that, in spite of, you know, the amazing advances we've made technologically with recording music, it's something that I think that warmth and that hominess we've lost a little bit.
And so much of the new music is coming out on vinyl, too. It's not just revisiting classic albums. A lot of the new groups release a vinyl and a CD now. So folks with turntables can listen to the nice warm sounds of vinyl.
And we're getting a call about Turntable Tuesday. Let's take it really quickly, if we could. It's Larry in Arlington. If you can put him in the queue, we'll get him connected to you. Hey, Larry. Good morning. Oh, he hung up the phone. Maybe he was giving you a request. I don't know.
No doubt. Send him.
Send him to
music at wjct.org. And we love suggestions.
That's right. And you get them from all over the world, actually, not just here in Florida.
We sure do.
He's our own music director, David Luckin. Hot Nights Cool Jazz kicks off at midnight July 4th all summer long. It'll be a summer-long, late night and early morning programming block of cool breezes and instrumental and vocal jazz tracks. Everyone from Miles Davis to Norah Jones. David, always great to see you. Thanks for bringing us the music every night.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I think we'll close with a little more music. That is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs our board during the hour. Our show theme is composed by Pyotr Chevchik of the Jacksonville Symphony. 1A's up next. Why a recent FBI report says the assumption that all active shooters are mentally ill is misleading. I'm Melissa Ross, and we'll be back again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Our rebroadcast is tonight at 8 with the Electro Lounge. After that, enjoy a little more jazz and stay cool out there.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.